You are now listening to the Hack My Age podcast, the show that brings you guests for the woman going through the menopause journey. I'm your host, Zora Benamou, a gerontologist, certified sports nutrition, menopause, and breathing coach. I'm the author of The Longevity Master Plan and the cookbook Eating for Longevity. And if you're a woman in perimenopause or postmenopause, check out the programs on the hackmyage.com website to biohack and optimize your menopause experience, because menopause is inevitable, but suffering is optional. So now please head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review to help others find us too. This is a really important point because it costs nothing, but makes a huge impact for me to support a podcast from menopausal women to normalize this conversation about menopause and attract even more amazing guests to the show for you and for me. Hey there, biohacking besties. If you're navigating perimenopause or just dealing with those pesky menopause symptoms like hot flashes, fatigue, unexplained weight gain, you're not alone. I get it. The struggles with belly fat, crappy sleep, a racing mind, thinning hair, and that all too familiar feeling of anxiety or mood swings. Or maybe you've just experienced those mysterious symptoms like phantom smells, itchy skin, and achy joints. And these are all signs that you may be heading into the menopause transition. Yep, even if you're only 40. And it's not even rare to have these symptoms in your 30s. So just be aware. But here's the scoop. Menopause may be inevitable, but suffering is completely optional. You don't have to just tough it out because it's a natural process that women have endured for centuries. Yes, it's natural, but no, you don't have to tolerate the pain anymore. And that's why I've created specialized menopause biohacking programs just for you. This is not the usual recommendations like get a fan and dress in layers. We are talking about biohacks, which go beyond what most people even heard of to treat menopause symptoms. So head over to the hackmyage.com website and snag the hot flash program or the energy reboot program to hack your fatigue and optimize your menopause transition. And whether you prefer self-guided, affordable masterclasses or fully guided programs with a supportive community of women and me who are facing similar challenges, we have got you covered. Every Saturday of the month, we start a new cohort of women. You get an exclusive 10% off any program with the code HACKMYAGE. So gotta act fast, especially if you want a spot in the guided program, because we keep it intimate with a maximum of 20 women to give you the attention you deserve. So don't let menopause dictate your journey. Let's conquer it together and head over to the Hack My Age website now and start biohacking menopause. I want to let you know that we got a new sponsor called Nibu Naturals. This is an amazing skincare, but kind of makeup, kind of skincare. It's actually two in one, and I absolutely love it. And you probably heard the little clip about it in my intro, so I won't go too deep into it, but I just want to say thank you to our sponsors, because all of our sponsors, because this is what helps us run the show, and they depend on us listeners to also test out their products. And you know, I'm a stickler for who I allow to be a sponsor, so I'm really proud to be able to sponsor, to have Nibu as one of our sponsors. So today's episode, we wanted to cover the questions that we didn't get to in our first recording with Dr. Sarah Ballantyne. And what happened was that she got me her book kind of last minute. I went through it and I was blown away. I really, really loved it. And you're going to hear how much I liked it in this episode, so I won't go into it. But she did a great job. And I thought we would cover the book and some of the things I learned from it and then go through the other questions, but we didn't get to do that. But I pulled out some really cool points from the book and that I think you'd love to hear, because a lot of things surprised me too. And what I liked best about it was that it's all inclusive, and she lifts off this demonization of certain foods in our diet. And I think it felt like a weight lifted off of me when I was reading it. I was like, oh, thank God, you know, because she pulls out all the science behind it too. So you're going to hear all about it. I'll Just want to introduce you first to who she is, Dr. Sarah Ballantyne. She is not only a best-selling author, but she's also a medical biophysicist who is really such a great educator to so many. She's quite big on Instagram, and you can go follow her there and see these little reels that she does. It's just bite-sized bits of information. She does a great job. And she really thinks that the key to improving public health, because she's thinking about a wider level too, is scientific literacy. So she explains a lot of the science, but doesn't get so geeky that we don't understand. She does it in a really good way. And she wants to really make us aware of the harms that are done about healthism, diet culture, dogmatic misinformation, predatory marketing, all of these things. She really pulls out under the rug and exposes them to us and really shares how to digest that information and so that we can make really good informed choices that are best for us. And what you may not know about Dr. Sarah is that she's also a really dedicated mother, and she loves to cook. She's an artist, and she even loves to perform stand-up comedy. And you can see all of this like beautifully tied together in her social media channels, all with the handle name Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, which I'm going to include links to that in the show notes. So she certainly is a very multi-talented woman. And before we start the show, we have to read the fancy disclaimer that the information provided on this podcast and any other communications from or provided through us is not intended as a substitute for, nor does it replace, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. All right. Well, welcome, everyone. And I'm super excited to welcome Dr. Sarah Ballantyne again for the second time. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we did have such a great interview in January of this year, 2024, and I really recommend everybody to go back to that episode number 181 to hear what are the top five foods women in menopause should eat. We talked about the importance of nutrient-dense foods and particularly those B vitamins when it comes to depression, anxiety during menopause, which foods to eat to build muscle, and an introduction to Nutrivore, which we'll cover a little bit more today. But So I do want to get to the questions that we didn't cover in that first interview because we were so chatty about other things. And plus, I want to talk more about your new book that's coming out. But actually, I want to talk about the book first.
Okay.
we always do them in the end, but I'm so excited about it. You did such a good job. It's really, you jam-packed it with science, like every sentence had a citation to support what you were saying, and then explains how you created the Nutrivore system. And you included so many great points about food and menopause, even though this isn't a menopause book, but you did include us, which was awesome. And you covered things like osteoarthritis and thyroid health, which are really big concerns during this transition. But what most impressed me is the myth busting section. And you know, when I put down that book, it was like a sigh of relief. It was like, oh, just chill. Don't worry about it. And I really want to start by sharing some of the insights that I got, but you know, without revealing the whole book. But we need to cover some of these things. Is that okay?
Yeah, please. I'm so thrilled that you enjoyed the book and got so much out of it. I think the challenge for me in writing, I mean, it's a nutrition book, but it kind of lives in that world between diet and anti-diet, right? It's kind of this like weird space in between where hopefully there will be more books that kind of live in that space. But right now, Nutrivore is kind of alone in that it doesn't really fit solidly into either camp. It kind of takes the best from both worlds, I guess. But my goal with that book, just to kind of take a high level, right, is to give people the information they need and the inspiration and the practical resources to improve diet quality in a sustainable way. So when we feel deprived of our favorite foods or we break the bank every time we go to the grocery store, those are not, that doesn't make a higher quality diet something that's easy to stick to. So it's very much about lifelong healthy eating patterns rather than a short-term diet you kind of have to white-knuckle your way through to get whatever short-term benefit. This is very much about lifelong health. And then to teach all those important concepts in the context of there being probably more misinformation about nutrition online than there is good information. So having to kind of clear that slate and clear the air and kind of like correct some of that misinformation so that we can accept new information and do all of that in a way that is actually interesting and fun to read. And I think that that was the biggest challenge in writing. And let's face it, it is a diet book, even if it isn't a diet, to write that in a way that incorporates storytelling was really fun for me to write, but also extremely, that's a tall order. And I love that you like found it like really engaging, that you really enjoyed reading it. So yeah, spill the beans. You can tell everybody what's in the book. Like that's, I'm cool with that. I don't hold back any information on my content.
Oh.
And I think that the more I share what's in the book, I feel like that actually helps people decide if it's a good resource for them. So dig in.
It is a good resource, I can tell you now. I think there's so much food. What's it called? I just lost the word. People are just demonizing foods. I hate people demonizing foods because then it causes eating disorders. It causes problems. And I think the thoughts in your head count. It's not everything, but they do count. And for me as a nomad and I'm traveling all over the world, I can't always get organic and I can't always get fresh and I can't always be perfect. And so it's like, all right, you know, you read this book and you go, okay, it's actually not a big deal. It had to be perfect all the time. And it brings a sigh of relief. And then again, this confusion that people get when you say, don't eat this and don't eat that. And that's bad for you. And that's going to cause inflammation. And this is going to kill you. And this is going to give you Alzheimer's. This is going to give you, like, you just go, you can't move. And you've just lifted that off of my shoulders. And I think a lot of people will enjoy it simply for that. And could just relax. So I really appreciate that because I think I know a lot about nutrition in general. I'm not a nutritionist, but I've been working on myself as a biohacker and testing out different things. We love to test and measure and assess. And just, you know, when you think about it, yeah, it's you don't need to freak out. You need to just eat. Okay. Eat real food. And that's where it boils down to. And you do put things in a perspective as well. Okay. You know, I think we're going to talk a little bit about that too. It's not just eat whatever you want all the time. It is nourishing your body. But let's start with this. This one was, yeah, I want to pull out some things that I thought were kind of surprising to me. It was very interesting. You mentioned this 2002 study that showed that people who regularly skip breakfast have higher morning cortisol levels that fall off more slowly than people who always eat breakfast. Okay. So that was an interesting study that you brought up because you talked about skipping breakfast. And in this whole biohacking and wellness world, people are all into fasting and intermittent fasting is a broad term, but you said breakfast skippers also had higher spikes of cortisol after lunch. And a 2015 study showed that women who regularly skipped breakfast had disrupted cortisol rhythm, hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis overactivation. That's the HPA axis, right? Your central nervous system, in case people don't know what that is, and an elevated blood pressure, even though they had the same levels of perceived stress, how you're looking at the stress, as the women who always eat breakfast. And so this was an interesting point, I thought, for women going through menopause or perimenopause. We get these Dutch tests, these dried urine tests, and it shows you the cortisol levels. Or maybe you just take a saliva test and you can see the rhythm, the cortisol rhythm. And this reminds me of one point. This could have been my case, although I have to understand what you mean by defined as skipping breakfast. But I had a higher cortisol spike after my lunch. And I remember my doctor at the time was like, what are you doing after lunch? Like, are you exercising or are you, you know, I'm like, no, but I thought, well, I do have coffee. And she's like, okay, now go decaf because maybe that's spiking cortisol. But now I'm wondering, maybe I was kind of skipping breakfast around that time or, you know, delaying breakfast. So I want women to understand that it could be of many things why their cortisol levels are rising or falling at in midday. But I thought this was something I haven't heard of before. And I'm wondering then kind of what would you define as delay, I mean, skipping breakfast completely.
To take a higher level view to this question first, because I think talking about the benefits of breakfast, it kind of contrary to a lot of the messaging from people who recommend intermittent fasting. Studies overall show that the metabolic benefits of intermittent fasting come from that being a strategy that many people find helpful for reducing their caloric intake. And some people find that is the only strategy that helps them to avoid caloric excess and potentially even lose weight. And so I want to like start with like this caveat that all like if this is the only strategy that actually works for you to keep caloric intake at an appropriate level, right? Because eating too much is also very inflammatory and it has all kinds of negative health impacts. If that is the only strategy that works for you, you're not who I'm talking to. I am talking to somebody who has other strategies that they could be adopting that could make room for breakfast, because breakfast is an important regulator of the HPA axis. It does seem to be an important signal to our circadian rhythms through cortisol regulation. So all other things being equal, if you have other strategies at your disposal, breakfast is a really beneficial habit. So it's the more specific, like what counts as breakfast? So studies kind of define this in different ways, but the consensus is around within 2 hours of waking. So some studies go, okay, but it's got to be before 8:30, but really they're basing that on an average wake time of 6:30 or 7 in the morning. If you design a study where you tell people to eat breakfast, usually those studies will be designed so that they tell people to eat breakfast between 7 and 8:30. That's typically the time range that they're given. That's all based on the assumption that you work a normal 9-to-5 job. Do you know what I mean? Like it's all based on that as an average.
And they're not in Spain, because Spain is everything's delayed. Sorry.
Right.
So there are other people around the planet who are doing other things.
So studies that look at late breakfast will define that as 5 hours after waking. So that's where they would draw that cutoff if they're specifically studying the health impact of a late meal, and they'll call an early breakfast within 30 minutes of waking. So what's fascinating is eating too soon after waking, we can actually have like still too much melatonin in our systems that actually impedes our digestion. So it actually is okay to not like rush to the breakfast table when you first get up. So somewhere around that like 1 hour mark is probably optimal, but like there's lots of wiggle room here. So typically studies will say, okay, it counts as breakfast if it's within 2 hours. And then that weird like 2 to 5 hour range there. I mean, scientific studies aren't designed to study the sliding scale in between things, right? They only want to study that the black versus the white, like the many, many shades of gray in between. It's really hard to design a study around because you get into so much noise. But yeah, that is where the science is at. It's like breakfast is within about 2 hours of waking, and it's probably best not to eat for that first 30 minutes. So if you're, sleeping in and you're rushing out of the house, that's not as ideal as I have time to like get up and maybe have a shower and get dressed and then go downstairs and have my breakfast. That's sort of where we get the best digestion efficacy and the best impact in terms of the not just like the circadian rhythm, HPA axis, like cortisol regulation, but also the best metabolic health benefits, because there's also studies showing that people eat breakfast have lower risk of type 2 diabetes, lower risk of cardiovascular disease. They have better blood sugar responses after lunch. So that all of that seems to be regulated, like the mechanism behind that is cortisol, probably. There might be some other things going on, but the benefits of breakfast are like really, really well understood. There's really a large body of scientific evidence showing, I mean, not breakfast is not the most important meal of the day. We don't want to go and say that, but it definitely is an important meal of the day.
I agree. I'm a big breakfast eater too, but that's why I was wondering, yeah, because of the time. And that's important to know, it's like within one hour or so of waking. And it, definitely who would agree with you was my professor when I was studying gerontology, Dr. Walter Longo, who's all about longevity and aging. And he said it like a million times too, breakfast, don't skip it. Super important. The people who skip breakfast die earlier or sooner, or like they have worse problems, worse outcomes. And so everybody got scared and we all started eating breakfast.
There's a really interesting positive feedback loop here as well, which is that skipping breakfast is a physical stressor on the body, but also people who have high psychological stress tend to have lower appetite in the morning. Like which one's the chicken and which one's the egg? I don't think science actually can tell us like which came first, the skipping breakfast or the high stress, but they definitely feed into each other in like not a way that benefits us. I know that when I first started reading this research in like 2018, I think, I was a breakfast skipper. I was never hungry for breakfast, and I'd have coffee in the morning, but then that would be it until usually like 11 is sort of when I would eat sort of a brunch at that time. And I started working on breakfast as a habit. And it was really hard because I just did not have the appetite. My cortisol at the time was through the roof. So it all tracks. And so I started with just like a small, like a really small breakfast, something that, you know, wasn't going to like super upset my stomach. So I would have something like a banana. And then I kind of graduated from a banana to a protein bar, right? Like it was just something really like not too much. And then gradually I got into soup for breakfast, and it's still one of my favorite breakfasts because warm.
You and I talked about that
comforting
in the last episode. Yeah. So I thought I was weird with my breakfast.
It's warm and comforting. And I mean, you know, for me, it's leftover soup. So it's just as fast as breakfast cereal. I just need to throw it in the microwave for 2 minutes. So that's kind of when that soup for breakfast habit sort of for me started, was when I was just working on breakfast. And I can say that it took maybe a month, like at least a month or two. 2018 feels like a million years ago. So like fuzzy memory aside, but it did take a little while before I started to feel like I was hungry for breakfast, like my body was waking up ready for breakfast. But also one of the biggest things that I found was that my appetite was better regulated later in the day and my cravings were lower later in the day. And so as somebody who has a history of eating disorders, you know, being able to have a better regulated appetite, better regulated cravings so that I don't hit disinhibition and start unraveling my eating behaviors, like that was a really important thing to experience. And then it kind of, my cortisol also, I think it was like 6 months before I did my next test, but then it was starting to come down. So I think that working on that cycle, it helps to work on the stress outside of just breakfast as a habit. So it helps to work on getting enough sleep, maybe including some activity, some nature time, some mindfulness type activities, because all of those things will help that breakfast habit kind of fall into place a little bit faster. I think for me, I did not necessarily have all of those pieces together when I was working on it.
The soup for breakfast idea it makes sense when you think about you've been fasting all night and sort of throwing in a bunch of food that you need to work on and digest. Soup seems like a nice, easy transition to then eating, you know, other hard foods. I'm not a nutritionist, but I thought, oh, that just kind of makes sense. And you can slowly transition. Cause I know people who do long fasts, they don't want you to like go straight into the real food. They want you to eat soft foods and liquid foods and all that first. So that would be, that's actually not a bad idea to do, you know, even though it's just breaking maybe a 12, 14 hour fast, it's actually really smooth. This, my personal experience too, I also was not feeling hunger in the morning, and it was usually because I was eating a big dinner at night. And so of course I'm not hungry in the morning because I just ate a huge meal at night. So what I did was just eat less at dinner. And then I found myself obviously being more hungry in the morning. So it was such a simple hack for me as well. And I'm wondering though, if you noticed, is there any better absorption of the nutrients if you eat the breakfast rather than delaying it?
I don't know that this has been studied in the way that would lead to a really definitive answer of that question. We do have some interesting, like our ability to digest starchy foods does kind of track with our circadian rhythm. But I think in terms of like absorption of vitamins and minerals, I haven't seen studies that have convinced me that there is much of a difference compared, like depending on when you eat. Like certainly if you're eating in a very high stress state, that does decrease, you know, stomach acid production, which is an important signal for everything digestively that happens downstream. You know, really our bodies are pretty good at absorbing vitamins and minerals. The things that are more impacted when we're eating in that very stressed state are like fat soluble nutrients, because we need, you know, bile acids, we need the lipases from the pancreas. So those are things that are much more like how much is secreted into the first segment of the small intestine called the duodenum is directly related to the pH of the contents leaving the stomach. So if you're not making as much stomach acid, you're getting less pancreatic digestive enzymes and less bile that helps to break up larger fat, like globules into tiny little droplets that make it easier for the enzymes to get in there and start breaking stuff down. In terms of like water-soluble vitamins and minerals, typically, if you have a healthy gut lining, you're going to absorb them, even if you don't have as efficient digestive processes higher up in the small intestine. I am not convinced that meal timing has a big effect on nutrient absorption.
Well, it depends if the cortisol is rising really high. Wouldn't you think that would make an impact if your cortisol is high in the morning? If you're stressed, if you're fasting, you're in a bit of a stressed state. I have no idea. I'm just thinking maybe it would. Since we don't have the data, I guess we can't make conclusions, but it'd be interesting to know one day.
Yeah, but I would imagine that the thing that it would impact more than anything is transit time. So it would be impacting how quickly things are moving through the digestive tract. And that's not necessarily, unless you're like crossing over into things moving through way too fast, that's not necessarily going to impact digestion efficacy, especially given that most people will eat a smaller meal for breakfast. So even if that's going through a little bit faster, which is what cortisol tends to do, we still would have ample opportunity. Like most material is going to move through in about 12 hours. 12 to 24, that's still ample opportunity for digestive processes to get the majority of the nutrients out of those foods.
This episode is sponsored by Oxford HealthSpan, the creators of my favorite supplement, Primadine. I admit it, I am a total supplement junkie, but if I had to choose only one, it would be this one. And it's because Primadine is spermidine, and this is shown to activate autophagy, which is super important. Now, this is a cellular cleanup and recycling process that declines as we age. So as we get older, our cells accumulate a lot of junk and waste, which isn't good for our cells, our health, nor our longevity. So we need to clean it up. And if you want the research on this, go to oxfordhealthspan.com and you can see all of it, showing how spermidine supports our brain, our hormones, and our heart health. And another great side effect is stronger hair, skin, and nails, but also longer eyelashes. But, you know, the real important reason why I love Primadine is because I have never, ever received as much feedback on a product I recommended as I have with Primadine. Literally, every week, someone reaches out to me on Facebook or Instagram with an amazing testimonial. And most of the time, it's about improved sleep. And even some of you told me it's reversed a bit of your gray hair too. So I find that totally amazing. So I can honestly say with 100% certainty that Primadine is the best spermidine supplement you'll ever find. And you can try it with a 15% discount by using the code Zora, Z-O-R-A, on oxfordhealthspan.com. Just be sure to get back to me with your results too. Now enjoy the show.
One question I thought was, or one topic you thought I thought was very interesting was you covered the topic of microwaving. And, you know, and this is again makes people, you know, relax a little bit more because we are so anti-microwave and scared. And then when you go, if you're eating out, you're probably getting some food microwaved. You have no idea what people are doing in the kitchen there. But yeah, so, and it's not exactly the first time I heard this. I heard it from Dr. Rhonda Patrick from Found My Fitness. And she talked about, I guess it was sulforaphane and how actually the best way to pull it out was by microwaving versus boiling or steaming or shocked. But why don't you talk a little bit about what you learned about nutrients and microwaving your food?
Yeah, so microwaving of all cooking methods tends to have the best nutrient retention. So we have the lowest loss, I feel like that's kind of hard to say, of nutrients compared to other cooking methods. It doesn't actually have to do with the way microwaves cook food. So microwaves work just by getting polar molecules to vibrate that generates heat inside of the food. It's non-ionizing radiation. It's not enough to destroy molecules, it's not destroying enzymes in a way that the heat does that. It's not the microwaves doing that, right? So it is it's very safe. I think there's a lot of, because we use the word radiation, I think there's a lot of fear just associated with hearing that word. But the electromagnetic spectrum from radio waves to microwaves to infrared radiation, including all of the colors of the rainbow, they're all just different types of radiation. And the thing we want to know is if it's ionizing, meaning it can knock an electron out of orbit around an atom, which is the type of radiation that has enough energy that it can actually cause damage, versus non-ionizing. So microwaves are non-ionizing radiations, pretty low energy type of radiation, and it heats our food and cooks our food simply by getting polar molecules like water to start vibrating inside of our food. So the reason why we have really good nutrient retention is in part because that heat is just being generated by molecules just starting to wiggle around extra compared to normal, but also because it tends to be low water cooking methods, right? So you maybe put the microwave safe bag of green beans directly into the microwave. The only little bit of water is whatever was in that bag, or you have a microwave safe dish and you add a tablespoon of water. Whereas when we steam or boil, those are higher water ways of cooking, and we typically don't drink the water when we steam or boil something. And so we end up having some nutrients kind of leach into that water. That's why if you ever look closely, sometimes the water, when you're dumping it out, will have kind of a green tinge if you like steam some vegetables. That's some nutrients that, not a lot, like it's fine. It's fine if you like steamed or boiled vegetables. Like you're not losing a ton of nutrition, but you're losing slightly more than low water cooking strategies like microwaving. So it is perfectly safe and actually has some of the best nutrient retention out of various options for cooking something.
Well, my mom used to drink broccoli soup water. Like she'd cook with it. I was like, what are you doing, mom? It's like 30 years ago. I guess she knew something.
Making sure nothing goes to waste.
Yeah. Exactly. Amazing. So there were a couple of other things you also debunked. I thought were really, you debunked so many. It was organic versus non-organic and frozen and canned versus fresh. Which one should we cover first? Because I think the
whatever you find most interesting. So I should say, like, chapter 10 is entirely dedicated to busting myths about food quality that are really pervasive in the like diet and weight loss industry, as well as the wellness community, to kind of differentiate. We have a lot of overlap between those communities, but also there are different types of messages that come from one or the other. So it's everywhere from the safety of eating canned foods to whether or not animal foods are good to eat, to there's like a million myths about seafood safety, organic versus conventional, the myths about plant toxins. And then I even have a section where I really talk about toxicological principles and understanding dose when it comes to additives and preservatives, and include a little bit of an examination of food dyes and MSG. So I really try to like cover the full range of myths, all with the goal of driving home the main message, which is that it matters much more what types of food you're eating rather than the quality of any individual food. Because the nutritional differences between, let's say, the cheapest olive oil and the most expensive extra virgin olive oil are not huge. There are some nutritional differences. If you have the budget for the expensive stuff, that's great. But you're still going to get benefits from that bargain basement, dirt cheap olive oil. And so understanding that, I think, is really important for giving ourselves permission to not break the bank, not spend half of our income on groceries. Like I think that is one of the most damaging things about the wellness community right now, is this like constant raising the bar of, oh yeah, you thought you were doing all of these things right. Well, actually you need to buy this more expensive food. Oh no, actually now you need to buy this more expensive food. Now you need to buy the super expensive supplement every month, right? It is constantly shifting towards expending more and more money towards health when that's not actually necessary for health. And it also, I think, makes healthy eating more accessible, because there are huge areas of the United States where you can't access fresh vegetables. So being able to say, yeah, canned and frozen are great options. They are equally nutrient dense to fresh and they're perfectly safe. Go for it. They're more affordable. They're more accessible. I think that's really important for lowering the barrier of entry towards improving diet quality.
It's so important to be all inclusive, because you're absolutely right. When you think, yeah, most people just go, I can't do this. I can't afford it. And they buy whatever they can and they feel bad. And then again, those messages in their head, they count. So you've really done a great job is to include those people who don't have the budget or who don't have the means, who can't get access to this stuff. And they can be more healthy than anyone else, as long as they get these, get the principles right, get enough vegetables, get enough, you know, real food and yeah, other things in your diet. As long as it's, you know, you're not eating Twix and, you know, Coca-Cola and all this, like you're talking about real food.
But some Twix and Coca-Cola can still fit into a healthy diet. I think that's the other, that's
I meant only that,
covered
only
in chapter
that.
Four. But yes, yeah, but I think that's another thing that I think we have this mentality in the wellness community that is perfect or bust, right? You do everything right. And as soon as, whether it's you like give into a craving or you're traveling and you can't get your normal quality food, or you're at a restaurant, or your company somewhere, something happens that, or you accidentally eat something you didn't even realize it was one of your foods that you were supposed to avoid until after you'd already eaten it. The wellness community kind of teaches us that if you falter in this like perfect, whoever you're following, whatever they're telling you is perfect, then all of your efforts don't count, right? Like that you just destroyed all of these things. And that sort of feeds this like guilt blame cycle that is driving a disordered eating patterns, because we don't need to be perfect to benefit from a healthy diet. Absolutely not. And the more we set ourselves up that perfect is the only thing that counts, the less sustainable we make that healthier diet over the long term. But I think that it also is driving that yo-yo, that cycle. Like I'm sticking to it now. Well, I messed up, so I might as well eat whatever I want, right? So it's driving that sort of vicious on again, off again cycle. It's also supporting the moralization of foods, the moralization of ourselves when we eat those foods, and then the moralization of health. So it's really actually propelling healthism, right? I am a good person because I have good health, and I deserve my good health because I eat good foods. You must be, I'm going to judge you. You have bad health, so you must be a bad person because you must be eating bad food. That comes out of that perfect or bust type mentality. And so being able to lay out the science saying, yeah, up to 20% of your calories coming from ultra processed foods, can of soda, Oreo cookies, like whatever, a quarter pounder with cheese, like whatever it is that maybe gives you joy or is a convenient food that means you actually are going to eat that breakfast, say, instead of skipping breakfast. Like those foods, we don't want our diet to be overabundant in them, but we can absolutely intentionally incorporate some of them, either because we like them or because they fit our time and energy constraints or they fit our budget. Maybe that's all I have access to, right? Maybe that's all I can afford. And I think that understanding that you can still craft a healthy diet with including some of those types of foods is a really powerful message, again, in the interest of both making healthy eating accessible, but also making it sustainable, something that we can stick to for our whole lives.
It would be great to do a study. I'm not sure if you heard the study where it was done on housekeepers and doing physical work with their job. And they were told, there was a group that was told that the benefits of movement and exercise, and they were actually, you know, burning a lot of calories or doing whatever, when the other group, they didn't say anything. And then after several weeks, they tested their biomarkers and their weight. The ones who had the information and the education lost weight, their blood pressure was better, the cholesterol was better, like their whole biomarkers were better, just because they had information. So I would love to see a study where we have, well, now we have the information from your book. Now those people who, quote unquote, you know, I hate the word clean, because that clean implies that those people are eating dirty, because it's just right. So wrong. But those people are feeling bad that they can't buy organic and they have to eat canned or go for that burger or whatever, that if their health could improve simply by having this information, just have the weight lifted off of them, I think it'd be a very impactful study. I think you'd have good results.
I hope so. I think there's two pieces to that coin, right? So there is the alleviation of psychosocial stress by, right, like knowing that you're actually doing something good for your health that actually reduces stress, and that just the reduction in stress is going to cause all of those benefits. But there's in habit formation research, there are studies that show, for example, if they take people, they often look at things like flossing your teeth, right? Like they'll say, and they'll take one group of people and they'll like explain to them, like, here's all the benefits of flossing. Here's why flossing is a good habit. Here's how often we want to floss. And the other group of people, they'll be like, you need to floss your teeth every day, right? And that's all. That's it. That's the whole thing. And sure enough, the people who get explained why this is a beneficial habit have way higher success in actually developing the habit around flossing than the people who are just told to do it. And that's measured in automaticity. So it's measured in how easily it is for someone to just like go do it without necessarily having to think about it, right? It's just, I just do that every single day. And that I think is the ultimate goal with healthy eating, is that it is a healthy habit, is that it is our default that doesn't require thought, right? That doesn't require energy. It doesn't require willpower or dedication. It's just how we eat. We overall eat a healthy diet. We feel we're eating foods we enjoy. We're eating foods within our budget. We feel satisfied when we eat. We don't feel like we're deprived of anything, but our overall diet quality is really high. And that's just how we live. That is the ultimate goal, is to make healthy eating a habit so that it is automatic. It is the default mode.
That's the way it should be. I agree. You know, healthy eating shouldn't be diet. I mean, it just should be normal eating, and everything else should be, I guess, diet, change of diet in case you're going to, I don't know, whatever, but it's not, it's just normal to eat normal. I really appreciate you explaining that. I wanted to talk a little bit about ergothionine. Is that what it was?
Ergothionine.
Ergothionine. Yeah. Ergothionine. Yeah,
antioxidant amino acid. Yeah.
What's that? Oh, okay. Let's talk about that.
I would love to. Okay. So I think when we talk about protein and amino acids, what people typically, like the information that people typically know, is that protein is a really important nutrient for helping our bodies make muscle, that improves our metabolic health, and that one of the things we want is to have a complete protein, right? So that's one that contains all 9 of the essential amino acids out of the 20 amino acids that our body actually uses to make all of the proteins inside us. But there's like 500 amino acids. There's so many amino acids beyond those 20. And many of them have roles. We just don't like incorporate them into proteins in our body. But that doesn't mean that we don't use them. And some amino acids, like some of these interesting, they're called non-proteinogenic, which means they're not used to generate protein. Some of them have really fascinating roles. We can make maybe a little bit ourselves, which is why they're not an essential nutrient. But when we get more from food, we have even more for our bodies to use. And ergothionine kind of falls under that umbrella. So ergothionine is really powerfully antioxidant, which then, of course, antioxidants tend to then also reduce inflammation. They tend to reduce the risk of all of the diseases associated with aging. And that is true with ergothionine. There have been a couple of metabolomic studies where they take blood samples from people and they look at all of these different chemicals called metabolites in the blood. And they go, okay, so what correlates with your health? And when they look at healthy aging, the one that stands out, the one that's always there, the one that's always like, the higher it is, the longer people live and the longer they live healthily, right? So like not just increased years, but increased healthy years, it's ergothionine. And then you get into like the more details and you see it reduces risk of like Alzheimer's disease and type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, decreasing risk of just all of these things that are, our risk increases as we age, and they are the conditions that really erode quality of life as we age. Ergothionine reduces the risk. And when you look at population studies, the populations that have a lot of ergothionine in their diets are populations that tend to live a lot longer.
Where does it come from? Where do we get it?
The main food source. It's actually not found in high amounts in very many foods, but it is very dominant in mushrooms. Mushrooms are the best food source. There's a few others, right? We can get some in tempeh and asparagus and chicken liver. Like there's a few other places we can get it, but mushrooms are our most reliable food source. And actually, if you look at people who eat more mushrooms, they also have lower risks of all of these conditions associated with aging, and they tend to live longer. So we've got so many reasons to eat mushrooms, but I think ergothionine is the most interesting.
Yay, I love them. Eat them every day, and I change the varieties. And if I remember, you said it was oyster or shiitake, or what, there was one that was better than just the button mushrooms.
I think it's shiitake, but I have the book in front of me and I could find this table pretty quickly.
That's right. You had tables. So if you organized really well, the different tables, and people can find their favorite food, say whatever, and then find your Nutrivore score. So this is a calculation. This is not like you pull out of magic out of air, and you talk about this in the book. So we won't go into deep detail, but there is a scientific method how you score each food. And yeah, and I want to talk about some of the top ones too. It's there. You found your table so fast in that thick book.
Now, to be fair, I have lived and breathed this book for 2.5 years. So if I couldn't find it quickly, we would be questioning my brain at this point. But yeah, it is shiitake mushroom, which has maybe 8 times more than white button mushrooms of ergothionine. White mushrooms, if that's all you can get, they're still a great food source. Mushrooms you like. Don't feel bad. But shiitake is the top, then enoki, then maitake, then oyster. And then other types of mushrooms like brown mushrooms, white mushrooms, portobello mushrooms, and also like tempeh are like in that, all in kind of like the same range. So all kinds of useful tables. And to me, that's all like, it's fascinating information, but it's also really actionable information, all sprinkled throughout the book.
You do make great actions. And I just want to mention too, I used to live in Hong Kong and I travel throughout Asia a lot, and I love the variety of mushrooms they have there. It's not just 2 or 3 different kinds. You go to the market and there's just dozens and different shapes and colors, and you're like, where did this come from? So, you know, that gives you a clue too. I mean, those populations are pretty healthy and living quite a long life. So let's take our mushrooms from them too. So you do give actionable steps. So towards the end, after you explain all this, you're like, okay, now how do I do this? So I'm glad, you know, you have boxes that you can tick to make sure you get the rainbow of colors, and you explain how the plate should look, which, by the way, is my plate, where you have a quarter for starchy vegetables.
It's a ripoff of my plate. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I don't create a plate. I'm saying
few important differences. Oh, you mean your plate?
Like, it is my also plate, what I eat every day. I'm like, oh, cool. That's what I do. You know,
it's also completely like it is how I would have created the USDA dietary guidelines for Americans.
Should be.
Graphic summary, my plate. So it intentionally looks similar with some really important differences in terms of both what goes where, but also like how much goes where. It's actually more geared at increasing vitamin and mineral intake, and also keeping macronutrients in that happy medium range. It is more successful at doing that than how my plate is put together.
No, you have a great visual, and I also like the fact you show a palm size or a hand. And that gives people an idea. You don't have to be weighing on a scale and figuring it out. And I think some of these things, you know, people don't have to do it. You can read this book perfectly fine without it. But if you really wanted to get gritty, then yeah, you can get great guidance just towards the end of the book. And then you've got the recipes, which I love as well. So well done, Sarah. I'm really praise you a lot. And I'm really proud of you, because this one really engaged me. And I did not expect this. I was like, I'm just going to read this book and we'll get to this thing. And I just was so happy after I read. I just felt so good. So thank you.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it. I think, I'm just at the early phase of people actually getting to read it. As we record this, the book comes out in 12 days. So the only people who are seeing it now are like the lucky, you know, few who are getting early access. And that feedback means all the world to me, because the amount of myself that I poured into this book, I think you can see, right? I think reading it, you can tell how much research and that sort of intellectual effort, but also how much heart went into the writing. And so it's so gratifying for me to know that I did write the book that I set out to write, that I did write a nutrition book that you can't put down. That is such a tall order. And I appreciate your feedback so much. And I'm so glad the book could reel you in like that, because especially I feel like as somebody who knows as much about nutrition as you do, like being able to show you something new and interesting, like that feels so gratifying to me. So thank you. Thank you for loving the book. And I feel so gratified that you did.
I think people can feel the love. I love that you did this and you appreciate it. So this is what our oxytocin is so high right now. Like,
yeah, I'm good. This is definitely the equivalent of my 12 hugs per day.
I love it. I still have the questions from the last interview.
Please, let's do it.
Well, no, we have to let you go because this is already reaching an hour, and I have to let you go. And I know that
the quickest hour ever.
Can you believe it? It's gone. It's all gone. And I want to talk about osteoporosis and the guidelines that you registered, and the brain health, the cardiovascular health, and there were so many other questions that I had before I even read this book, but. Since I read it, I have to talk about it. So, and we did talk about your website, your Nutrivore website the last time as well. So you I don't know how you do it, but you create these magnificent things that are huge. And I don't know how you find the time to do this. And
to be fair, I do have a team. So while I was completely ignoring the website and writing the book, my team was continuing to work on articles for the website. So to be fair, the website is a team effort. So, and I really could not do everything that I'm doing without my amazing team. So it is not just me. Like let's make sure that credit goes where credit is due.
Oh, that it's powerhouse. It's powerhouse. Both are great. And you've got a great team too. So before I let you go, like what about I know the book is coming out. It's a pre-sale in May very soon. What date is it going to come out?
It comes out May 14th.
May 14th. Okay. So I have the link where they can get it, but they can also get it on Amazon or anywhere other place where they get their
every
books.
Main online bookseller. So it's on Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores. You can walk into a local store and order it, whether that's a chain store or a local independent bookstore. And obviously, maybe not obviously, I highly encourage if you have an independent bookstore to support them because I think independent bookstores are the best. But if you like the convenience of just being able to order it and having it delivered to your doorstep on release day, that also exists from the big online stores as well.
Perfect. So I'll have the link to that. Is there anything you want to mention about the book before I let you go other than that? I mean, something we didn't cover. I don't know. I want to give you the opportunity because I just, loved it so much. Is there something?
I feel like we've had a fun kind of drilling down on some of the sort of like myth busting type stuff, but I did write this book for a really wide audience. So it is both for people who've kind of like been steeped in restrictive diets, who have a lot of food fears and kind of need this information to be able to move beyond those food fears and expand their diets to increase their nutrient intake, but also for the person who feels like a healthy diet is not attainable to them, that it's like too much work, but also the person who has like no idea that nutrition could actually like help their health problem. So it's kind of like that whole range, and even, you know, nutrition professionals, like that full range of people, like I really kept all of those people in mind as I was writing. So there really is something for everybody in this book. And this book is very much designed to kind of go hand in hand with the website. So any topic that's on the book, if you want to get into like the super weeds on that topic, there's an article on the website that will get you there, but the book is also completely self-contained. So it does also everything you need to know.
Perfect. That's Nutrivore, the radical new science for getting the nutrients you need from the food you eat. I'll have links to that book as well as links to you on TikTok, YouTube, Instagram. You're mostly Dr. Sarah Ballantyne all the way. So I will have that in the show notes too. And before I let you go, do you have any last words for a woman going through menopause? Even though we didn't talk so much about menopause, but you know, you're going through it.
But to say something different than last time, let's talk about the benefits of nutrition. I think there are, you know, last time I was on the show, we talked about menopause insomnia and how vitamin B6 can help. And obviously next time I'm on the show, we will talk about osteoarthritis and osteoporosis. I think we've got clearly more things to talk about. There are a lot of health challenges that increase risk when we go through menopause, but also menopause itself kind of poses some challenges to our quality of life, right? There's really things that kind of come along with that transition that are not fun. And all of those things are at least in part tied to our nutrition. Nutrition's not always, it's not going to be the miracle cure. It's not going to be the only thing. You're still going to want to talk to your doctor about whether or not hormone replacement is appropriate for you. There's lifestyle factors are still important, right? So like when we're talking about bone mineral density, it's not just nutrition, it's also weight-bearing exercise. So like going for a walk is a really important signal to our bones to make more bone. So nutrition is never going to be 100%, but it is so profound at the same time. Not everything, but it is so much.
Well said. Well said. And you make it easy for us. So please, guys, go pick up the book. Thank you so much, Dr. Sarah, for your time. I really appreciate it. And you just did such a good job. I'm just so proud of you. And I cannot wait for part 3.
Thank you again so much for having me back. And I'm sorry we didn't get to all the questions.
Do it again.
I'll just do that last little bit.
Yeah. So thank you so much. And I hope you have a great day.
Thank you.
Today's episode is sponsored by the Institute of Bioidentical Medicine, which is the authority when it comes to understanding bioidentical hormones. And I just completed their menopause method course, and I am mega impressed. This is a self-paced course designed by Dr. David Rosensweet, who's been treating women through menopause for nearly 3 decades. And I can highly recommend this program, particularly if you're a doctor or someone who is actually prescribing hormones to women for menopause. So make an appointment at iobim.org to see if you're a candidate for the menopause program and ask for a discount with the code ZORA, Z-O-R-A. You're going to learn so much with this program because menopause is inevitable, but suffering is optional.
You can now watch all of our podcast interviews on the Hack My Age YouTube channel. Some of our guests bring slideshows, so it's really great to have. Every week there is a new video, so just search Hack My Age on youtube.com or find the link on the Hack My Age website.
Hey, did you enjoy the podcast? Don't forget to subscribe to be notified of all the new episodes and leave a review to help build the tribe. It's a small act of kindness that brings me big benefits and helps others find this amazing content. The best thing you can do is share. Sharing is caring. Statements made on this podcast have not been evaluated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Anything we say or products we mention are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Information provided by this podcast is not a substitute for personal medical advice and not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It is intended as a sharing of knowledge and information from the personal research and experience of me and my guests.